The E-commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell, the most popular, largest upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 of those big spending Shopify Plus stores, and they've generated over $200 million in revenue for the merchants that use them. And you may be thinking, oh, hey, Andrew, I've heard of OneClick Upsell. I know these guys, but do you know what they've rolled out recently? They've got some cool new stuff. For their pre-purchase and their post-purchase upsells, you can now select from multiple different offers to present your customers. So instead of having them just have to pick from one single thing, you can give them the option to pick from multiple upsells, which helps and has proven to increase the number of people who actually take you up on those upsells. So if you're not using upsells in your store, it's an amazingly easy, fast way to increase your average order value and your revenues. So check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And I can't remember when it was, maybe sometime in the last 3-4 months, but I was on Twitter seeing all of the ridiculous stuff that's on there these days. And I started noticing a pattern of this very helpful, interesting, insightful leadership lessons, quotes, thoughts. And sometimes you get these and sometimes they're very lofty and almost cliche and they're not very helpful. But these were the type that were much more actionable, thoughtful, seemed battle-tested, and just useful in general. And so I started kind of diving into the profile and realized there's this guy named Dave Klein who was sharing a bunch of this stuff and actually really knew what he was talking about. So I dove a little bit deeper and realized that he'd come through a lot of this knowledge by route of working at Bridgewater Associates, which is, I don't know, at the time, at least now, I think of it's one of, if not the largest hedge fund in the world. I believe it was co-founded by Ray Dalio, very well known. And he was the co-head of the Department of Core Management and Recruiting there before he left to start his Business Now Management Accelerator, which is a newsletter and a course. And anyway, slid over there, hassled him on the DMs. He generously agreed to come on and talk. And Dave, thrilled to have you on. Thanks for being here and excited to dive into what I would say, I don't know if you would agree, but at least in my experience, is the hardest part of business. So excited to get all your thoughts on this.
Andrew, I appreciate you having me on. It wasn't that much arm twisting once I saw you were in Montana and I was, it's a favorite place. I like to spend some time, so.
Yeah, well, it's funny. We were going back and forth, and you actually were flying in right when I was there, and we it didn't work out. You had some plans, and just timing didn't work. But the next best thing, and hopefully next time you're out, though, we'll be able to sync up. I want to start with something though. We're going to get to leadership. We're going to get to management, hiring, recruiting, all the thorny stuff that pulled people in with the title. But I want to talk about something much more important for the first 3 or 4 minutes here, and that is, like you mentioned in the kind of when we were talking before recording, your daughter just made the varsity soccer team at, as an eighth grader, which is pretty impressive. But you have like very mixed, you're a high performing, super smart individual. I'm guessing you want the same for your kids or your daughter to push them. But like you also had some concerns about that. And I think it's kind of very timely. And I've thought about this as well. So can you, why is that not the best thing across the board in your opinion?
Oh, I'm not even sure if it's the best thing or the worst thing. Like on one hand, couldn't be more proud, right? Like I think, as a parent, one of the things we aspire to is just, can we create fully functioning, independent adults, like, people who can set goals and go achieve them. And quite honestly, like this was set by her, something she chased, something she went and achieved. And so on one hand, I'm like extremely proud, but as you and I were talking about beforehand, it's even in the 20 years since I was playing high school sports, it's become this machine, right? This was probably her eighth tryout. Almost 14 years old. I don't think I had a tryout till I was 14 years old. There's the strength coaches and performance coaches and, there's mindset coaches for middle school kids. And you're just, is that level of pressure? Is that level of travel? We travel quite a bit for soccer, probably more than most. And I still know hockey parents who are flying across the country many weekends a year. And I don't know. I just sort of like, are we losing too much in all of that? For these kids. And so I'm just sort of like, are we doing right by them? And yet at the same time, it's hard to hit pause and say like, no, we're going to choose an alternative path because you just sort of watch how quickly these other kids grow and develop and, kind of price out the other kids who aren't keeping up.
Yeah. Does she love it through and through? Like, is she just, is it, you have some kids who are just, I know someone in my network, actually guy that I went to high school with, and he was a phenomenal athlete. I played baseball with him. I mean, he threw a baseball and broke the glove out of the back of my ball. I got yelled at by the coach, and I was like, my pocket broke out. What am I supposed to do? I just, phenomenal athlete. But he was so driven by, I think, members of his family that, like, at the end of his, by the end of his career, like, in, he could have played college sports, but he's like, I'm done, you know? And like, so is that, but then you have people that are just, you know, kids, they're just deeply passionate about it and they have this internal desire. So which one is it for her?
Man, I'd love to, I think it's the latter. Like, I think she just really loves the game. Like, she does lots of other sports, yeah, but this one she loves, you know, days off, they're still, you know, juggling in the yard or going for a run. It's not really all that much prompting, but you wonder, like, again, this is sort of one of those parent weights you have on your shoulders, which is like, but we show up at the sidelines, we cheer, we invest, we do the driving. I mean, how much are we signaling with our actions? You know, like, it's very easy to believe that, like, embedded in that is some sort of like tacit approval that they're chasing as well. You know, so how do you support without necessarily being nudging in the direction? But I think it's mostly internally driven. That's how we let her lead as best we can.
Yeah. And I think it's like, it's not even just sports, right? Like, it's like this, sports is one facet of it, but I think it was, my kids are younger than yours, 10, 8, and 5. And like, as a parent, you want your kids to have a great childhood. But you also, there's this fine line between like letting them be kids, pushing them enough to prepare them for like, for college and adult life and sharpening them. But there's that, you know, the tension between those two. And I feel like the tension obviously I wasn't a parent 20 years ago, but my childhood, and this is where I start sounding like an old man. Like, you just, you know, we played sports, but like you said, like my first tryout was, I think, 7th grade basketball and then 8th grade, right? Like, and you could play multiple sports and we weren't having to do like, you know, there was no like, hey, you've got college prep, 5 hours of homework at like 8th grade. I don't know. Maybe the world has changed to the degree that this is actually a service, but I'm more of the inclination that like, give your kids a little bit more space to be kids, to like be able to connect, to have some room, to not get, and you look at also some of the mental health trends with kids. It's not all based on academics or sports. There's other things, but I think there's a little bit of an awareness of like, man, they're kids. They're not even 18. Like, let them enjoy. The world is hard enough, right? Like, when you get to 18 and beyond, let them have a little bit of their youth before we just sap it all out for the sake of like performance and achievement. So
my last thought on this was, you know, my wife and I grew up in the same small town in upstate New York, and like, we both reminisce. Like, we both grew up in different neighborhoods. We remember, you know, going out, playing till dark, parents yelling for you to come in. And partly what I took for granted is it worked because all the kids were there. You know, so even though I have this romantic version of like more space to go play, and honestly, more space to be bored. Like, there's some value in being bored and learning to deal with that. You know, all of a sudden you sort of come home and you're like, go out and play. And the kids look at you like you're crazy because they're like, with who? You know, this friend's at this sport and this friend's at play practice, this friend's, you know, doing extra tutoring. Like, there's no one to actually go into the neighborhood and just be bored with. You know, and so now you have, but we have this crutch, which comes in a roughly this size package that is on their person at every time. And so that's the other thing tearing at us. We're like, well, at least when we're busy playing sports or chasing theater, like our other daughter does, like it means they're engaging with other people. They're being parts of a team and they're not on their phones.
Yeah. It's funny to say that. We, at home in Montana, the neighborhood we live in, it's a place where you could be in Burbank, you know, you would not know you're in Montana, like right from our street. It's very suburban. It's a wonderful place, but it's not a place I have any affinity towards in terms of like the neighborhood. It's very, very suburban. But the reason we stay there and the reason why I think it's really great is like, there's a herds of kids that run around. Like, any given day, we'll have 7 or 8 kids in and out of our house with our kids. Like, we had a handyman over doing something one day and he kind of looked around. He was just like, oh my gosh, like, are these all yours? And I was like, no. He's like, man, you got your hands full. Makes it hard to work from home. It can be a little annoying sometimes, but the fact that like, just the communal sense of kids being able to run around is super cool. And I think increasingly rare. So
hang on to that, man. Might be an anonymous neighborhood, but I wouldn't leave it if you've got that set up.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to. All right. Thank you for going down that little route for me. I thought it was, you kind of mentioned it. I wanted to pull on that string a little bit. I want to talk, so before we get into leadership stuff, radical candor seems to be one of the themes. Maybe that's even the actual name for it at Bridgewater. So for those that don't know, Bridgewater has a very extremely transparent, open feedback culture where everything you do is I think all the meetings are recorded. It's just, you're measured on dozens of metrics. It's a level of candor that I think would make almost everyone squirm, but is, you can't argue with the results in that environment. A question for you, having worked there and been a huge part of that and driver of that, is that a good model for most companies, right? Like the talent threshold at Bridgewater is tremendously high, really some of the smartest people in the world. I'm guessing you also are screening very heavily for people that are very self-aware and that are willing to reflect and take feedback well. So it works well in that organization. Do you think that's a model that like should be adopted by your average entrepreneur? Let's say someone, they've got a $6 million business, 10 team members, they're smart, they're driven, but they're not Bridgewater. Like what parts of that do you think work well for general adoption and only work well for Bridgewater?
I would have said that if everybody was three steps away from Bridgewater, probably most companies would benefit from taking two steps in that direction, but probably not all three. It's to your point of like just sort of painting the picture for what three steps would look like. Yes, every meeting is recorded. Like every room when you walk in, you're like, oh, it's the meeting, and you push the button and it's recorded. It goes to a central repository. You can pull it. We had a tool for feedback. So when I was there, everyone had an iPad. The expectation was you brought your iPad to every meeting. If you were in the meeting, you were giving feedback to one another on 60 attributes. So it could be, wow, Dave's storytelling was really creative. Here's an 8 on creativity, but he rambled and didn't really make his point. And so here's a 3 on synthesis. And those observations would go into effectively a public Twitter feed. So anybody in the company could look me up and see every piece of feedback I had gotten through time, as well as how they rolled up into different attributes. And so in theory, that was going to paint what they would call a baseball card of places you were strong, places you were weaker, which would have let you assemble better teams, know how to work with each other better, et cetera. But that idea, like I left with something like 12,500 pieces of feedback. You know, so for most, you know, so three steps, you know, like people are like, wait, you got 20 pieces of feedback like in a year? And I'm like, no, like day. 20 pieces of, and it could be anybody. They could be on my team in junior. They could be brand new to the company. They could be the CIO. And so anyways, like that's pretty extreme. And I think if you are in an organization where, you know, you're trying to do something really complicated, like understand the world, that was Bridgewater's desire. And they believed the best vehicle was this idea of debate and dissent and like people being able to bring, without any fear of retribution, new ideas to bear. Whether that idea was about how the markets worked or how you were performing, that was sort of baked into the culture. And I think it worked because you signed up on the way in. Like it was crystal clear. You had to watch videos of people being fired in front of 70 people. You had to like sort of sign off that like you knew what you were getting into. They told me, I mean, speaking of the Mountain West, my wife and I had joked, like they told me that it was a coin flip, that any experienced manager who came into Bridgewater was usually fired, like half were fired within a year. And so we had a deal, which was like, well, we'll make it at Bridgewater or we're going to move to Jackson, where we had spent some time and loved. And so I don't know if I won or I lost, but I did spend 10 years at Bridgewater. I think the parts where you could move towards that for most companies, though, is we create these continuums that I think are like false choices all the time. Like people will say, I'm really struggling to give feedback to people on my team. They're not changing. They're not evolving. And they sort of paint feedback as being either kind or clear. And I'm like, well, those aren't a continuum. Like you've made that up. Like honestly, being clear is very kind. You don't have to be like a jerk about it. But if we were just talking about sports, right? If someone was like playing out of position, you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't do a feedback sandwich, which is, oh, you kicked the ball really well. By the way, you're out of position. Oh, but I really love your hustle. You would just be like, get back in your position. Like you're exposing our team. Like we don't need to have a long dressed up conversation about that. And I think somehow that's okay on the 14-year-old sports field, but it's not at all okay in the office. And I'm like, well, why not? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not being mean. I'm just saying like, we're here to win. I need you to do what you're supposed to do. I'm trying to do what I'm supposed to do. Tell me when I'm screwing it up. I'll tell you when you're screwing it up. I'll tell you when you're good too. Please tell me when I'm good too. I'll keep doing that. And so I think something like that, a lot of companies would be better off as long as everyone knows that's the deal.
The principle of like, it seems like when you have a really deep relationship with someone, or at least some level of rapport, you know people care about you. You know your boss or your leader cares about you deeply. It's easier to take feedback because you know it's coming from a place of like, you know, of goodwill and trying to do something positive as opposed to just rag on you. So I mean, have you seen that that's the case? Like the stronger the depth of rapport, and I don't know if what the right word for it is, but maybe a caring bank account or like a goodwill bank account, that you can give more candid feedback, or not necessarily? Is that a false assumption?
No, I think it's a good assumption. It's a good assumption, but I think you want to put pressure in both directions. Like, I think there's pressure that you want to put, if you're like, let's imagine you're the owner, you're the CEO, you're the leader. I think you do want to put pressure on, how fast can I race to trust with my team, right? Like, how fast can I make those personal connections so that we then can be more candid with each other? Because you have, like you said, you've built up the credits on the I care about you side. And so you can take these criticisms. The downward pressure I think you want to put, though, is to like bring the hurdle for how much our relationship has to be like deeply caring and trusting in order to be honest, right? So Bridgewater did that in the extreme by basically codifying it in the culture, making you watch videos. But I think you can do it just in the day-to-day with like how you carry yourself as the leader, how you interact with people, like how you don't, if people give you feedback, like do you react to that well or do you overreact? You know what I mean? Do you actually go out and solicit people to give you feedback? Like you can do lots of things that sort of, it will actually do both. It will probably build trust with them, but it'll also bring down just like how big a deal feedback is. And I think if you do that, then you can get to that sort of fluid, you know, more like playing jazz style work environment.
Yeah, you had mentioned that as looking into your course, which you've got a fantastic looking course that we're going to talk about here in a little bit, that kind of walks you through a lot of these basic principles, almost like a leadership, you know, not boot camps are not the right term because it's advanced techniques, but really kind of helps you, especially for those of us who are so in the weeds or busy with business that you forget about one of the most important things, which is learning how to lead your people well. And it's probably the number one skill you can have just in business in general. Anyway, you had, I think it's probably a curriculum, like the number one skill, one of your first things you teach is like, the number one skill in management, if you could just do one thing really well, is like know yourself really well, know what kind of manager and leader you are. And why is that so important for effectively leading others?
We do start there, actually. And by the way, if you want to call it a boot camp, I'm totally fine with that. Because like I think about boot camp and it's like, it's hard, but you actually get stronger and you're learning and it's very condensed. Like that's our goal. You know, like I think a lot of people hear management training or leadership training and they picture like a stale conference room and like someone who's actually never led a team telling you about a theoretical framework and then going away. Like we're trying to be the opposite of that. The reason I start with this idea of self-awareness is a couple of things. So one, I was writing about this today, actually, like a lot of people get promoted into management for the wrong reasons. Like it's the primary path to make more money. And even if they get promoted in for the right reasons, like they fail to be equipped by their organization to be like, it's just a different craft. Like you being the best salesperson in the world doesn't make you a great sales manager. You being the best software developer doesn't make you a great leader of software engineers. And so a lot of it's a famous book by Marshall Goldsmith, like what got you here won't get you there. And so there's this idea of like, well, where do I start? It's like, well, what am I like? Like, what type of leader do I want to be? Where am I very strong? Where am I very weak? Like, what mindset do I bring into this organization that's going to serve me as a leader? Which one might actually be a problem? Like I grew up relatively lower middle class. My parents split early. I was like the man of the house at 12, so to speak. And I like developed this huge self-reliance. Like I wear it with pride that like when something breaks in the house, I can just fix it. When the lawn needs to be mowed, I would mow it. And that served me so well, like served me super well early in my career. Like I would pitch in, I would stay late, I would do extra work. And that led to a bunch of promotions. But at some point, it became a liability. Like I wasn't putting the limited hours I had in the day to best use because I was doing things that I took pride in, but I could have outsourced. I could have delegated. I could have hired someone to do. Like, yeah, no, like me paying myself $15 an hour to mow the lawn doesn't make any sense. You know, like the kid down the street should do it. And I can use my time to do something that's more impactful, et cetera. And so you kind of have to start there. Like, what's that inventory of what you're like to then turn around and say, well, what team do you want to put around you? What are they like? Where are they complementary? And then one we talk about a bunch in the course is like being really careful when you're trying to hire that diversified team, when your superpower is their kryptonite. Like if I am super creative and I'm smart enough to hire someone who's like extremely organized, I shouldn't get fixated on them not being super creative, especially as creative as I am. Like that's the wrong bar, you know? And so that all of these conversations become clearer and more fluid and intentional, but it starts with you knowing who you are.
If you're, I mean, to that, you kind of hear both sides that you should be very aware. I mean, you just touched on one of them, but when you're thinking about hiring a team, and it obviously depends on the role and the circumstances and things, but is it dangerous? Like I enjoy marketing, right? Like that's, I kind of my skill sets is probably one of the ones that I definitely am a better marketer than I am a leader or like a manager of people, in my opinion. So is it dangerous to go out? Like what are the dangers of hiring people that have that same skill set that you have, like, especially if you want to build a business that you can run and lead, but not be in day to day. So if I'm looking to hire a marketer, what are the dangers I need to be aware of when I'm out recruiting and trying to find that person?
Yeah. I was going to say, I think the answer is it depends on why you're hiring them. Like, I think if you are trying to, like you described, get yourself out of that, you might be a marketer by background, but you're like, oh, I want to start working not in the business. I want to work on the business. I want to like be able to elevate to something more strategic or get out of the day to day. Then I'd say like the closest you can hire to yourself, the better, right? Because that's going to be like, if you're sort of holding yourself as the archetype and you can go find someone who's very close, then the gaps you'll perceive that you have to close are very small. If you're you might be hiring for very different reasons though, right? Like you might be still in that stage where you're like you're handling the marketing and you need the complementary people for other parts of your startup, or you need somebody who is like offsetting like a pretty big gap in what you have, you know, in which case I would then look the other way. The thing that I think transcends both, where I think if you said to me, where do people make the most mistakes hiring, especially early teams, is in an effort to get those either the replacement skills or the complementary skills, they compromise on character, right? Like the first 4, 7, 10 people in your organization are ultimately going to dictate the culture of the company that you have at 25 or 50 or 100. And I think it can be really hard because you feel like, well, I'm small, I'm unproven, I can't pay as much as other people. I had this acute need, or, you know, we just turned a corner, we've got product market fit, I want to scale. And all those pressures can lead you to say like, I'll take the skills and I'll compromise on my culture. I'll compromise on this particular value they don't share with me. It almost never works. Like it's so rare that I see someone sort of compromise at that level and look back and be like, that was a good call.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, hiring people and hiring great, great people. You also had a tweet that said something, and this is from the employee side, kind of looking towards a position, but you said your employer has plenty of money to pay stars what they're worth. They're just unwilling to make the hard choices to do it. Can you unpack that a little bit? And also, like, what do you mean by that? And then maybe a secondary question too is, do you feel when you're hiring that any good hire should be able to pay for themselves in like within 6 months? Like, because I think a lot of times people, there's just a, you know, when you're ponying up six figures, maybe even multi six figures for a role, it is next to the mortgage on your house or maybe other investments for a lot of people, even business owners, it's probably one of the biggest investments you're going to make. Anyway, so how do you, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that quote and just also just hiring high performers and their ROI and payback period.
Yeah. I almost wanted to jump through the screen and be like, yes. I don't know if it's exactly 6 months. I don't know if it's like double what they make, but just sometimes we make things, we like rationalize things that aren't quite right and by making it too complicated. And so just keeping it that clear of like, every person I bring into this organization should at least pay for themselves, if not generate excess returns for the organization. You know, so yeah, salespeople should sell more than they get paid. And because you have that overhead, you've got to offset that too. And so like, I love that framing. Like, yes, they should definitely do that. The spirit of that tweet, I kept starting to see a couple themes lately. And I was just like, oh, it bugs me a bit. But one of them is this idea that like, you know, like, oh, I won't be held hostage by people who are demanding more money and all of these ideas. And then another one, just like, I'm losing good people and then I'm going to go turn around and recruit a new person. And I'm like, oh my God, both of these are like such bad calls. Like in that same idea that you were just saying, like if the person is like all of a sudden generating 2, 3, 4 times the value of what they paid, they are probably a little underpaid. You know, you can look at the market, you can be smart about it. You don't necessarily have to like give them all of that value. But this idea that like, okay, well, what hard decision aren't you making? Like a lot of times companies will just fall back and be like, we don't have the money. And I'm like, well, what underperforming employee do you have who you're tolerating? Like who's the person who's creating X, like fractions of a return as opposed to multiples? What role do you have that's just like not that valuable? What client aren't you firing? Like all these things are taking resources that if you no longer had to do them, you would in theory have excess money. like paper money or real money that you could then redeploy to these stars, to keeping them, and they produce excess returns. So there's like that rational idea. There's also just the irrational, like usually people are asking for like another $10,000 or another $15,000 and just play the alternative out. The alternative is they leave, you go rehire someone. Now let's imagine you could rehire someone who's $25,000 to $50,000 less a year, but that role was empty. So how much money did you lose while the role was empty? You then had to onboard them, and like there is some probability risk they don't even fit to your company. So now you're like, you're empty for 3 months, you're onboarding for 3 months, 50-50 they're a fit, or even if it's 75-25, all of a sudden you're like doing the math and you're like, you're making a six-figure choice to save $10,000. And I'm just like that, I keep seeing business owners make that call and I'm like, it's a bad call. Like go make a harder choice somewhere lower value in the stack so you can keep your best people and build around them. Ask them to contribute more. Most of these people will. So that was the spirit.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Largely a lot of, just a lot of on focus. Do almost boils down to just do less, do it better, do it with really high quality people. Obviously, you know, course on leadership, like what you largely do professionally is teaching people how to elevate and grow the skill. But where's the cutoff for that? Some people, just like you mentioned, are not. Sometimes you have people that are, you know, kind of the maker type that just love, they're world-class watchmaker. You put them in, try to have them manage a factory of people making watches, the whole thing's going to go down in flames in, you know, 3 months. And so someone like, let's say for example, someone who's not predisposed to lead people, like maybe on a personality test, they're just, their leadership or that characteristic is just very low, but they're super smart. They've got lots of institutional knowledge. They're loyal. They're honest. They're a great cultural fit. Like where's, it's a raise your head, it's a decision, but how do you think about, do I put this person into a leadership role and develop them slowly with time, given those other benefits, or which one do you prioritize there?
Well, I mean, I guess I'd ask why do they need a leadership role? Like if they're not predisposed for it, are they angling for it? Or is it just tied to like, that's their only path to more money? Like what's the driver behind it? If not for, I can't help but lead others.
Yeah, that's a good question. For sake of argument, let's say it's just they're a known entity and with a lot of trust and a lot of institutional knowledge, and they understand the organization very well. So it's something where to get someone else in their position that was doing, had the rapport and that with the other rest of the team that understood the systems, that also, like you mentioned, like integrity and trust and is so huge. Like that's just paramount. You have that there. And you can do your, you know, even great hirers mess it up sometimes. So I was thinking that is maybe why the reasons they have all those attributes in play.
I don't know that I have like the perfect one size fits all. You know, like there's a world where you could be creative and say, I want this institutional cultural leader to have more of a mentor relationship with people on the team. Like I want them to use that expertise and that trust and bond. And I want them to help nurture and grow and develop other people. But I don't necessarily want to give them all the weight of people management responsibilities. And I could think about doing that with a second person who might be more predisposed to just sort of, some of it's like just organization, rhythm, and discipline, right? Like managing people, like you need to check in with them and you need to like focus on their development plans. You need to deal with the portfolio of people being out of, like when someone's out of the office, you need to, like, there's just like these mechanics that I think in the description you're saying, which is a pretty common one, that this like culture carrier sort of like almost like elder, like spiritual elder, might not be that great at. And so one is, so you split them. You just say like, I need you to play this role. You have someone else cover some of the other management responsibilities. I think a lot of it comes down for that person of like, do they want to do it? Like if they don't really want to take the full weight of that role, I think I wouldn't push them into it just because it's a little bit easier for you in that they have the expertise and the trust. I would rather like lean on them the other way and bring someone in who can do it. I think that one of the things that often happens is you sort of go that route. You bring in the second person and then all of a sudden this person, A, isn't as impressed with the newbie. And then B, you end up with sort of this like, this person has more merit as a leader. Like they are a leader by like the merit they have. And then you have this person who's now a leader by the authority or the role they have. And you really need that first person to be bought in to the second person. Otherwise, they can sort of indirectly or directly undermine it. And now you've got like multiple problems on your hand. So I would really want them to actively turn down the opportunity and then help be a part of selecting that other person if I was bringing them to like a relatively tight-knit team.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at E-Commerce Fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people if you're in e-commerce Fuel. Our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into to avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us at ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7- or 8-figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right. Back to the discussion. We have a lot of people listening, and especially in our community, that are the owner of the business. They likely started it. Most of our owners are bootstrapped. I mean, a few are financed, but most of them are bootstrapped with their own capital and kind of debt financing. And largely, like, you know, especially if they've grown, they're the CEO, have a lot of visionary tendencies, maybe less great at the details. And so looking for a COO, a great COO, like, you know, that this is the unicorn, right? You want someone who's great with people, that's super detail oriented, like the Tim Cook, right? Before he became CEO, like you want someone who can take your vision and really run with it and manage the team and execute it. It sounds great. In practice, significantly harder to find someone, especially with the people skills, because the people skills are just harder to find, I think. So any thoughts? Like, you brought a lot of people and a lot of managers in at Bridgewater and helped with that program. What would you recommend? Like, what are the most important things to look for someone trying to hire someone who's going to be a great manager for their team?
You know, it's interesting, when you were setting it up, I actually thought you were going to go a slightly different angle, which was like that whole visionary integrator concept. One of the biggest mistakes that I would see, because again, that same, like, we ended up hiring a version of that repeatedly. Like, a lot, Bridgewater would have a lot of like two leaders into a spot, one of whom was, we would have called them contentful, but someone who really understood the work, was the cultural or spiritual leader of the area. And then someone who was sort of the management integrator, like the people manager. So like, I think the setup you're describing, I see a lot. For me, the thing that made it work or not work, and we can talk about the right people to hire separately, does the visionary actually value the integrator? Like, because I think when you go from this owner world, so early on, you're both. Whether you liked it or not, whether you were good at it or not, you're in it all, you're doing it all. You were your own visionary and your own integrator. And the fact that you survived and have a reasonable business probably means you were maybe a great visionary, but decent at integrating. And then probably by virtue of having to do it, you probably went from decent to pretty good. And like, one of the challenges we would run into is like these visionaries who wanted someone else to handle that, but then no one else could do it as well as they could. Like, they were unwilling to compromise on them doing it differently. They were unwilling to see alternatives to doing it. And they would often get frustrated that the person wasn't as facile on the visionary side. like, why can't this person keep up? And so it's almost like you need that owner to be in a place where, like, A, I want it. B, I can sort of see alternatives, you know, and I'm willing to take more in the operational talent side in exchange for this. I know this person will be slightly less visionary than I am. And I'm willing to make all those trades. And I think if they're willing to do that, then we can talk about the right people to hire in that bucket. But man, we would put some really talented people in that bucket, and that visionary was not bought in, and it never worked.
Interesting. Okay. So first and foremost, make sure you are not expecting your COO to be exactly like you, an owner who cares much
about
the
business. That is a tighter way to say it. Yes.
2 in the morning and like, yeah, okay. And it's not going to be Superman across all skill sets. That makes a lot of sense. If people are bought in on that front, let's say you have someone who thinks they are, or hopefully is, then what are you looking for on the actual attributes to hire a great COO/integrator?
Yeah, for this one, then I think you're starting to get into scale. Do you know what I mean? Like if you hiring a COO or a head of operations, whatever you want to call it, for 10 people is going to be very different than for 1,000. Do you know what I mean? Like you're starting at that level, you are the 1,000 person COO is really managing managers. They're sort of like setting the direction, the priorities, they're measuring the business, they're keeping an eye on everything. And then they're just picking the people to run the different parts of the area and assessing them, growing them, developing them, motivating them, incentivizing them. Like that's what the 1,000 person one is doing. I think the 10 person one is probably very different, right? It's probably much more like analogous to a strong program manager with people skills, right? That you are going to be able to, it's some of those same things, but like at a much more granular level. Like you're probably in the actual work. You probably have to call, you're probably a player coach to some degree at 10 people, like having to call your own number to do some of the work. You're probably starting to like grow and develop certain people. You know, I think at that level, you're like on the people side, it's like, can you prioritize, delegate, set clear expectations, give good feedback, right? You're probably managing people who are on the ground doing the work. You're not managing managers. So I think it becomes a little bit more like line management with hopefully a lot of upside in that person.
When you were hiring at Bridgewater and even just throughout your career, do you rely pretty heavily on, and we're kind of getting more into hiring and recruiting versus leadership, we'll circle back here in a minute, but how heavily did you rely on personality testing for finding managers, roles, things like that?
And by the way, we can spend time in hiring and recruiting because there's probably nothing more important a leader does than to pick the team. I wrote a thing a couple of years ago about Sean McVay. It has not aged well since his team went like 4-13 last year or whatever they did, but it was right before he won the Super Bowl. And honestly, part of the big challenge is like he had this like very clear system, right? He borrowed John Wooden's like pyramid of greatness and like tailored it for the Rams. And then he sort of said, like, I sort of took my system and matched the talent I had and then traded quarterbacks. Like he sent Jared Goff off to the Lions. He got Matthew Stafford in. He was able to like adjust the system up for the quality of his quarterback and they won the Super Bowl. So we can definitely spend time on recruiting. Like you should put systems around the people to make the most of what you have, but like, wow, the ingredients you put in that system are darn important. And there's really no choice you're going to make more important than recruiting. With personality tests, we used it some. I would say at least in my time at Bridgewater, we experimented with all of them. Like if it existed in the world, we sort of gave it a shot and said, like, could we tie the output of this to be predictive of success within the organization? And the answer was like not exclusively and not super reliably. And so the best way that I found it to be most useful in recruiting was, and again, this was sort of a little bit premised on Bridgewater's culture, but I think it's probably true of most organizations. Like we wanted people who were, they were very growth mindset. They were constantly thinking about how they could get better, how they could improve. They were willing to contribute into a system of continual improvement, right? So at the nuclear level, you were basically saying, can you take feedback? Can you metabolize it? And can you apply it? And so the way that we'd use that with like our culture interviews was mostly like you have them take the personality test and then have them react to it. And then when they're like, oh, I'm like, you know, they're going to tell you whether they're like that or they're not like that. Usually people will be like, oh, that sounds just like me because most of them sound like horoscopes. You're like, oh, okay, great. Which one like, right? Which one contributes most to your success? Oh, okay, it's my grit and determination. Awesome. Tell me about a time your grit and determination like served you really well. And they give you, that one's all recorded. And you're like, great. Now tell me about a time your grit and determination undermined what you were trying to do. you know, and people are like, the ones who wouldn't have fit our culture would have no answer. The ones who would fit our culture would be like, let me give you the 15. Like, here's the 15, because they had constantly been examining, like, what am I like? Where's that coming up short? How do I get better?
And they're self-aware enough to be able to realize, yeah.
Totally. And the thing that we found, and so I think this applies to all companies. If you can figure out what your sort of like nuclear material is of culture, like for us, it was feedback. For other organizations, it's creativity. Like, I've heard a bunch of different ones. If you can figure out what that is and you want to interview for culture, you're way better basically going at the exact same thing over and over and over and over, because everybody has figured out that the 15 questions you're going to ask in an interview, so they all have the first answer. The people you want are the ones who have 10, because that's just who they are. Like, that's how they operate. So if it's a creativity, if you want to like test creativity, like keep testing and testing and testing. If you want to test the ability to metabolize feedback, just keep testing and testing and testing. And after two or three, you'll be very clear who's naturally aligned and who's sort of like had a good answer for you on the first one, and it gets worse and worse and worse. So I think that's the best use I could find on the personality test.
Got it. That's really insightful. You had a blog post about kind of unpacking and figuring out what drives your team, the principles. Principles, of course, is kind of the bedrock of Ray's book. But using that, some great questions you had on how the frameworks you build for your own business and culture as a part of that. I was really enjoyed that post. I'll link up to that in the show notes for people. You mentioned developing people. And like when I think about myself as a leader who needs a tremendous amount of work, I feel like developing people is probably one of the areas that is most glaringly apparent. What are some of the ways leaders can be more intentional and better about that? Because I think, frankly, if I just look at my experience, like it just takes a tremendous amount of intentionality and work over a long period of time to develop people. And most of the people that are doing this are by default busy, right? Like they've got tons of stuff going on. They're entrepreneurs. So any thoughts or suggestions, or how can people that are bad at it, like me, get better at developing people? And what specifically should, I mean, obviously what you're going to develop them in is going to vary based on their role. But a lot of times the people in those roles know way more about their roles than you do, hence why you hired them. So how can you get better at it? And what facets of their personal or their professional development and personal, perhaps, maybe even, you know, their non-business life, should you think about developing?
The short answer is get them to develop themselves. That doesn't cover it for you.
I was like, trying to lean in into the silence there.
Yeah, no, but I'm being tongue in cheek, but I'm actually being quite serious. And it's funny, we started with like youth sports. And one of the, like, my wife and I run this business together. We're both big sports fans. Like I think we both believed we were foundationally shaped by what we learned on the field growing up, for her on the court, for me on the field. And, you know, the idea of like, one of the best tricks I sort of learned in leadership was to like reject the premise. And so like the premise that I'm going to develop you is, it's just not a great premise. Like, you're going to develop yourself, and man, am I going to help you. But if you sort of go back to the sports analogy, it's like, okay, we're playing soccer. There's 11 spots on the field. Based on the system we're running, each spot on the field has a certain role they have to play. And I want to put the person in that position who has the right characteristics, attributes, natural abilities that come through naturally in that spot, right? And so the same is true for your business. It's like, okay, I've got a person, I have a specific system I'm running, whether I'm 10 or 1,000 people, here's this role. The ideal person in that role looks like X, Y, Z. Great. The person I have is excellent at X, is pretty good at Y, and could really work on Z. And so you're like, if I could wave a wand, I would just say like, Dave, get better at Z. But that's not how, we're complicated like beasts who don't like to be told what to do. And so instead, like the path I would go through with someone is like, okay, like you are playing this, you are in this role. Like, what are your personal goals? Like, do you want to get promoted? Do you want to grow? Do you want to like get deep in mastery in a certain capabilities? Because that actually matters. Like, different people are motivated by different things. Okay, what are we shooting for? Okay, can I get them to see that Z is a gap into what it is they're shooting for? And by the way, if they're shooting for something that's just like totally orthogonal to your business, you're probably going to have a hard time. But let's imagine what they want to shoot for is relatively in the ballpark. Great. Do we see that Z is a gap? Okay. Yep. We both agree Z is a gap. What are the resources, support, and experiences you need to close the gap? Like, what do you need from me? Is it training? Is it access? Do you need someone else to mentor you? Just like, What's the set of things that are going to set you up? And then I got to get you to take reps. The only way you're going to close, the only way you're going to get better at that position is playing it. And so how do I get you those reps? Okay. Can we then agree on how we'll know whether it's working or not working? Like, how will we know that you're getting better? Is that you're going to score goals? You're going to have assists? You're going to have tackles? Like, what's the thing we're going to be able to look at together? Great. When we come back in a month, what will you have done in service to closing that gap? And effectively, like, I'm just asking them questions and they're writing their own development plan. And so what I'm saying, like, have them develop themselves. Like, that's really the game, because it was their goal. It was like the alignment on the gap. It was their plan that I'm supporting. It was their way of being held accountable that they agreed to. And now it's just, now your little molecule of discipline for you as the leader is just remember, like, bring it up in a month in the next check-in and make sure we check in. And then adjust. Like, it worked, it didn't work. If it's working, keep doing it. If it didn't work, you know, partner with them to figure out how to tweak it and have them go do another month.
What are your thoughts on, I mean, to use the grossly overused, kind of very businessy term, the KPIs, the things. So when you think about hiring someone, you've got to measure them on some scorecard, right? Like, there's obviously a lot of qualitative facets to any role, but if you don't have the quantitative aspects, it's really hard to have a candid conversation. Say, here's where you're doing great. It's hard to keep track and see if people are where they need to be. But also, I have found, like, they are so, like, you take the Charlie Munger quote, like show me the incentives, I'll show you the outcome, right? Like, it's crafting good KPIs and those good scorecards are sometimes they're straightforward. Oftentimes I have found they're very difficult because there's always, hey, if we drive more signups, great. Is that what we're looking at? Oh, okay. Well, do we blow through the marketing budget and unprofitable spend? Like, oh, hey, did we appreciate our team members? Great. But, like, you know, you also spent $18,000 on, you know, to have, you know, this elaborate party for one of our members. So
they're really nice sweatshirts.
It's the only yak, you know, in this one part of Colombia. And we spent a special search party there and they got them and they made the sweater and it was only 18. 18,000 was a bargain for this sweater. So yeah, so there's so much nuance there. Anyways, and again, I'm asking you, it's so much harder to ask without like a specific situation. But thoughts on developing KPIs that, or goals, quantitative especially, that you can look at to see, hey, you're doing a great job, we need improvement, but also aren't going to create unintended consequences.
The two things at the more like conceptual level is, like, don't let perfect be the enemy of good, and get good at measuring. Don't get good at measuring one thing. So, like, on the first, the thing you're describing sounds so common. Like, I hear it all the time with leaders I'll work with, which is like, oh, I don't want to like set the wrong KPI because then I might have to overpay or I might underpay, you know, like, and so mm-hmm. in the effort to be perfect, they like don't set anything. And I'm like, there's so many better ways to handle that. Like, if you can't set the right number, set a range. If you can't like set it with high confidence, just like add a confidence thing and say like, hey, this is low confidence. We know we're both figuring it out. Can we agree it needs to be in this ballpark? Okay, great. In a quarter, then we'll have a baseline. Then we can like have a better KPI. And so it's a little bit of like, but start the process of getting better at getting better versus constantly sort of punt it because it's hard. A couple other things is that idea of like, but get better at measuring is like, I've never seen a KPI last more than 18 months without something changing. The threshold changes, the what you want to measure changes, the business changes dramatically. And so to some degree, it's like, know that you're going to have to re-agree on something different down the road. It's fine. Like, that is, I work with a bunch of startups and a lot of times it's like the same idea of like reject the premise. It's like, oh, my team gets so frustrated because we're constantly like moving people around and changing our focus on initiatives. And I'm like, oh my gosh, reject the premise. Like, it is a blessing to have it, to be in an organization so fluid that you can be redirected at a moment's notice at the most interesting, challenging, necessary work. Like, paint the alternative is like the bureaucratic stuff that you didn't want to be in the first place. And so like, go there. And so that same idea comes with the KPIs. Like, let's be fluid about it. Let's agree on it. Super tactically, to your point, the one thing I'll do is just set two that I know conflict, right? So if you're saying like, hey, I want to drive subscribers, but I also need to keep the cost per acquisition below X. And I'm like, okay, like they're going to offset. You're not going to be able to go to 1 million subscribers at 1 million ahead. And that's just another way to play with it. It's like, make sure you have two that create tension, right? If you want to put more cars through the factory, make sure quality is the other one.
Last question, and I got through half my notes here. I would love to just interrogate you for 4 hours, but that's not going to happen. So last question for
you. It can happen in October.
Okay. Again, hacking in October, actually. We'll be chatting about that as well. Avoiding making bad hires. You know, I think you had mentioned there's kind of three things that, you know, signs of common culprits, focus on the why more than the what, and use unexpected questions for authentic answers. I'd love to hear your quick and dirty take on all three of those, because I think that's, again, going back to hiring, making bad hires, one of the biggest fears people have when hiring and one of the most expensive they have too. So can you walk through those three? Like, what, talk about each one of those three and how people can spot potentially big red flags in the hiring process.
So wait, it was common. I wrote this one a while ago. So common culprits.
Common culprits, focus on why more than the what, and use unexpected questions for authentic answers. And feel free to ask me again as you answer each one, because it's, I don't remember one last that long
either. It might be in a slightly different order. So the unexpected questions one is just, two and three are pretty related. Like I found that no matter what my launching point was as an interview question, the interesting answer behind it was why. You know, it's not like, well, hey, tell me about this gap on your resume. I more wanted to know the, like, why, like what, you know, like, oh, I was like, I don't know, I was kind of distracted and lazy and drifting and whatever else, versus like, oh, I like purposely wanted to take a 3-month break. I had burnt myself out. I had this opportunity to go explore the world and whatever. Like, they're sort of the same answer, but they're very different. It's like sort of getting into the, like, what's ticking behind this person. And again, either of those two answers could be fine for different companies. You know what I mean? It just sort of depends on what it is you're looking for. But like, what motivates them? What makes them tick? How do they, what are the patterns in their decision-making? What are the patterns in the choices they make? When they were put under pressure, what did they retreat into? We were talking about personality tests earlier, right? I just sort of worked with the team. I was going through that. I was checking in their certification process at Principles U, which is the kind of a spin-off off of some of the tools we use at Bridgewater. And there's this phrase that stuck with me, which is like, traits are not fates. Like, yes, when you are put under pressure, you will likely go back to your preferences, right? Am I going to solve this problem by being hyper organized and detailed? Or am I going to solve this problem by being, like, you know, creative? Like, the, you know, like, but you can also choose out. Like, you, all of us have the agency. Like, if we're introverted, we can be extroverted today for an hour. And so that idea that you're not resigned to it. And so that's why the why behind it was so much more interesting to me, because it gave me a more, I just feel like it got to a little bit more the root of what that person was going to be like. And when they came under pressure, when they sort of had to make similar decisions, how they might operate. So that's why I have the why more than the what. And I found the way to get the more authentic answers was like just slight variance on the questions, right? You know, that idea of like, oh, tell me about a time you like encountered failure. Like, they all know that's coming. You know what I mean? But like a slight variant might be like, you know, tell me about something you really respect and a time you let them down. Like, it's the same question, but it's like, oh, it's framed over here in a way that's a little bit more, it's a little more emotional. It's a little bit more unexpected. And you'll be shocked by, like, you can get different answers. Like, it's sort of in the way that you're like, I have some questions for you at the end, but I'm not going to like preview them because I want the more like authentic, raw, live answer. Like, that is, it's the same thing.
What were you thinking when you spent $18,000 on the sweater? Like, walk me through that. These kind of questions, like out in left field.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're trying to build a very elite community and we want to have people working here who have that same level of taste. And so how could they operate in any way other than $18,000 sweaters? But anyway, so like, that's the spirit behind like, just, can you, and we put some of them in that newsletter, like, can you bend some of the questions in ways that are surprising enough to people that they have to answer them a little bit differently than what they've been practicing for months and getting coached on by their LinkedIn interview coaches. The idea of the common culprits is sort of, that one's a bit more born of just like screwing up so many hires myself, right? And so I probably won't get all the characters right, but like, I remember like just some of the big mistakes that I made along the way. One we talked about earlier is this idea of like, out of desperation, I would hire for skills instead of character. And a variant on that one, which we didn't talk about, is this idea that we grossly overestimate our ability to change people. Like, in the tongue-in-cheek way I was saying earlier of like, have them develop themselves. Like, especially when it comes to character, mindset, like things that are closer to you're born with than you can be taught. Wow, if you're banking on changing one of those on somebody, you are going to be so disappointed. You know, so that's the thing I would stare really carefully at, like, are you making that compromise? Another one is like I think it's an overused word, but I'm going to try to use it really precisely. This idea of like a toxic employee. I sort of feel like lately people are just like, oh, I disagree with that person. It's toxic. That's not at all what I'm saying. Toxic is like a very unique character. And they're what makes them so hard to deal with is they typically are like very, they tend to be very people oriented. Like they tend to be very manipulative. They tend to be high performers because if they were manipulative, but bad at their job, they'd be easy to fire. The reason they make it so challenging is they're often like your lead salesperson. They're like your best developer. Like they sort of are awesome and they know it at a particular craft. And then therefore don't feel like they have to make any sort of compromise on the like interaction team side. And that is like a thing to really watch out for up front. Like if you see someone, like when I see people bouncing at jobs, I'm not really worried about them changing jobs. I'm like, but was it because of that? Was it like high performing, but constantly toxic? So that's one that I would be looking out for. The other one that is so seducing is the, my shorthand form was the lovable B player. It's like you get the resume and it is like all your biases on fire at once. You're like, oh, your daughter plays varsity soccer. My daughter plays varsity. Like everything on the resume, like we're basically twins and we just can't help but like, and they're like so nice. They're often very earnest. You're like, oh, you're a perfect culture fit. And you start rounding up on the skills. And all of a sudden you've hired someone who's like completely, who's going to have nothing, at best will be have average impact on your company, on their role, but you're really going to like them. And honestly, like those people are so hard. They are so hard once they're in the door because they are so, they're great. Like they're great humans. They just aren't the right athlete for the position you have for the game you're trying to win. And so that's why I'm like, they're probably the hardest to catch yourself on, but they're also the hardest to let go once you have them in. So that was like the third character. I'm probably might be a couple more in there, but those are the ones that that come to mind. I certainly messed up more than I'd like to admit.
I want to talk about your newsletter and your course. So you have got a great newsletter. Is the best place for people to find it? Is it mgmt.beehive? What's the best URL for people to find your newsletter?
That is currently the best one. You can also just find it on any of my social profiles.
We'll link up to that, but a fantastic newsletter. And talk in depth, if you would, a little bit about your course. It's something, intensive, I think you said 8-week course, and kind of a boot camp apparently is a decent way to describe it. But yeah, give people an idea of what to expect. I was looking through it. I'm going to try to sign up for it this October. It looks fantastic. So give people an idea of what they can expect to see.
So we do it. It's 4 weeks. We do it twice a week for 90 minutes a piece. It's all busy leaders from companies you've heard of. So in October, we've got already signed up Amazon, Microsoft, Boeing, Pfizer, a bunch of startups, 3 or 4 AI companies. So it's just like a cool mix of leaders who are all trying to level up. We build in those 90 minutes. So I know it's theoretical to have you listen to me for 90 minutes and then off you go to do some sort of homework. So if we're covering delegation, which is one of the modules, you walk in with like a piece of work that you can't get off your desk and you leave with like the person identified, the like literal script you would use to talk to them, how you're going to oversee the quality of that work, et cetera. So each time we're building a little piece of your management system because we make three promises up front. We're going to break through your biggest management challenge. We're going to upgrade a couple parts of your system and you're going to meet three other amazing leaders. The one other thing that I think makes us different is we offer one-on-one coaching to everybody as part of it. That's mostly because I like to play games I can win. And I know that if I get everybody one-on-one, we can usually break through that management challenge so I can make good on the first biggest promise.
Is this for primarily COOs, CEOs, founders, leaders, anybody? Like who's the perfect fit for this?
When we started this 18 months ago, it was actually called the New Manager Accelerator. And 2/3 of the people who applied had 5 to 10 years experience, including a bunch of like founders and CEOs. And we were like, that doesn't make any sense. So I said no. And then we did a call with like a bunch of them that pushed back and they're like, no, I need to do this. And it just turned out that a lot of people were like, they're still drowning. They don't have any systems. They've been faking it. My favorite quote I kept hearing was like, I'm just doing the opposite of all the bad managers I've had. And it's lonely. Like they just didn't have a community of other people who weren't maybe competitively in the same company. And so we just did what any good engineer would do. We did an A/B test. So we had half of it be new managers, half of it be seasoned. Two awesome things happened. One, both got massive value. But part of the value was like the role they played for each other. So like the seasoned managers, harden their own understanding and their own tactics by like working with some of the more junior managers and the small breakout groups. And the more junior managers, yes, got the wisdom of these people, but we're kind of bringing things that are more on the ground, more cutting edge. Like they tended to be the more technical leaning, things like that. And so they were bringing this new stimulus to these more seasoned leaders. And so that mix, they all said it was great. And so instead of all the marketing instincts in me of like niche down and only do one or the other, it's a little bit of both. The true, I'd say the sweet spot, like we always look at like what are like, who are our 10 out of 10s and 100X. We ask people how much value they'd get if they apply it. And there's a handful who always say 100X. I think it's really people who are leading, either directly leading teams or leading managers of managers. They're usually scaling very fast. So they're just sort of overwhelmed. So that's why we get about 20% will be founders. Or it's just people who are sort of at the high trajectory part of their kind of growth in their leadership career. It tends to be tech, finance, startups, handful, and like a bunch of healthcare tend to be the three main areas people will come from.
Great. And again, we'll link up to the newsletter, we'll link up to the course. And when does the course start again?
October 5th.
October 5th. Great. October 5th. We'll get this published in plenty of time for that.
Awesome.
Dave, I had a ton of questions on lightning round here. Unfortunately, I'm only going to be able to ask you one of the many. And that one question is, best book on management or leadership you've ever read? There's a lot out there. It's kind of a hard question given the, you know, some of the big names, but do you have one that if you could only distill and just really internalize one book on leadership and management that you'd read?
I'm like gazing over at my, I'm like, what am I doing? My honest answer is the one I recommend the most, The Making of the Manager by Julie Zhu. It is, so she was a contributor turned manager at Facebook. And what I like about it is it's super, she's like just very practical, but systematic. And her writing voice is very accessible. Like it's not like steeped in theory. Do you know what I mean? It is steeped in a voice that I try to hold with what we write, which is like, I'm just sharing with you the stuff I screwed up. And then some of the stuff that I think I figured out. So it's like, it's just very candid and very humble. So that's probably the one I go to the most. And I think it's pretty good for really anyone new to management or even people who are probably 3 to 5 years in.
Great. Thank you. We'll look up to that one as well. Dave, this has been phenomenal. Thank you so much.
Andrew, thank you for having me.
Of course, like I mentioned, super active on Twitter. So at DKLINEII, we'll link up to that as well as his course, which starts October 5th, I believe, and the newsletter, which is just a phenomenal regular read. All those links will be in the show notes. So Dave, really appreciate everything put out there. Thanks for the time. And this has been a ton of
Given you've made it to the end of the episode, there's a pretty good chance you're fairly serious about this e-commerce stuff, which is why you should check out the E-Commerce Fuel community. It's a vetted, vibrant community for 7- and 8-figure brand owners. And joining gives you access to a lively discussion forum for experienced founders sharing insights and getting help, access to our library of over 20,000 member reviews on everything from agencies to tech to lawyers to all the things that, you know, founders are making hiring decisions or purchasing decisions on to run their business, and invites to member events throughout the year. So if that sounds interesting, you can apply for membership and learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Big thanks to One-Click Upsell from Zipify Apps. Rapidly increase your AOV by offering targeted high-converting upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And also to Fulfill.io, an ERP designed specifically to streamline complex e-commerce businesses and the highest rated ERP among our community members. Learn more at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network live from New York.